minutes after one, and we're scheduled to start at one, so we should get started. I'd like to take the opportunity to welcome you to the Transportation Committee for an overview on the, I guess we're calling roads. I'd like to introduce the senators that are here today, Vice Chairman Senator John Cowdery, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Joe Thomas, who's here with us. And last, Chairman of the House Transportation, introduce his members, if you would.
Thank you, President, Vice Chair Newman, Representative Johnson, Dugan, Fairclough, and Salmon. Thank you all for joining.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I have dual committee assignments happening at this time, both with presentations at the start, but they are voting consideration on two bills in Veterans and Military Affairs, and so my staff is going to let me know when that vote's getting ready to happen to go down, and I'll be departing, so I excuse the interruption, please.
Thank you very much for informing us. We'd like to ask now the commissioner to come forward, Commissioner Van Schaben, if you would come and introduce your staff, please. Of course, make whatever appropriate remarks you'd like to make first.
Thank you. Chairman Kukish and Chairman Johansson, members of the committee, it is a pleasure to me meet with you again. The Department of Transportation and Public Facilities has four main areas. It covers Alaska Marine Highway System, which we discussed last week, aviation, which is the rural airports, as well as the two international airports at Anchorage and Fairbanks. Public facilities and road are the fourth. We are here today to provide you an overview of the highway and rural airports portion of the department, as well as a little bit on how the federal government funds this department. If you are interested in something a little more in depth on the statewide transportation improvement plan, which is the vehicle that programs how federal funds are spent, we would be happy to arrange a STIP 101 class, which I have just completed, by the way. It is a complicated process that is getting more complicated by the day. Additionally, I want to let you know that we are preparing written responses to your questions from last week and hope to have them to you in a few days. The team I have with me today consists of some of the folks from last week and a few new faces. So I'm going to introduce them. John McKinnon will be running the show, so to speak, and he's the Deputy Commissioner. Nancy Slagle, Director of the Statewide Administrative Services Division. John Torgerson, Deputy Commissioner for Aviation. John Oatston, Director of Division of Program Development. Frank Richards, Statewide Maintenance and Operation Engineer. Mel Menzings, Regional Director, Southeast Region. And Mary Sicori, Legislative Liaison. I have to apologize. I will probably have to leave around a little after about 2-ish because I have to go to another meeting. So I apologize in advance. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to John.
Thank you. Just for the record, we have the schedule from 1 to 3, but if we get done before 3, that'd be one of our goals today. John? Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Senator Kukish, Representative Johansson, John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation for Highways and Facilities. Today, to give you an overview on the highway side of the Department of Transportation, and I did hear you loud and clear that if we do get done within the two-hour period, that you won't be offended.
Yep, right.
Let's see, I guess my job is to operate this thing here. Anyway, Department of Transportation overview before the House and Senate Transportation Committees. The mission of the Department of Transportation is, very simply put, to provide for the movement of people and goods and the delivery of state services. The department is organized around three modes. You may have seen this slide last week. We've got a marine highway side of it, which is, according to the current organization chart, has a deputy commissioner overseeing it. We have an aviation side, which is Deputy Commissioner John Torgerson, and then a highway and public facilities mode, which is under myself, and it includes a Division of Statewide Administrative Services, Statewide Design and Engineering Services, Division of Program Development, Statewide Maintenance, and Measurement Standards and Commercial Vehicle Enforcement Division. little bit about the geographical area of the department. We do have three regions, and each one of the regional directors reports to the commissioner. There's a southeast region, which is from about Icy Bay east, central region, half of Prince William Sound and west, and a northern region. Geographically, there's not equity here, but for a variety of reasons, they've been organized under this under these boundaries. Northern region happens to have a lot of the roads, a lot of rural area. Central region has the major urban population in South Central. One of the terms you often hear is national highway system. This map shows the national highway system routes in the state. There are 2,113 centerline miles of national highway routes. These include highways such as the Dalton Highway, the Glen and the Seward Highway, the Richardson Highway, are major routes in the state. NHS routes are federally defined routes that are approved by Congress. We don't approve them. We submit them to the Federal Highway Administration. Congress approves them for being routes within the National Highway Administration, and they have to meet very strict criteria for geometry of the roadbed and other features. We also have what you probably have heard before about the Alaska Highway System. These are routes of major importance but don't quite meet the criteria of NHS routes. These include routes such as the Taylor Highway, the Steese Highway, Elliott Highway, Denali Highway, not quite up to the standards of both geometry and traffic as the NHS routes. One thing I'd like to note on this, when you look at the mile of NHS and AHS routes we have, that on these routes there are over 765 bridges on those routes too that we're also responsible for. And in order to take care of all these roads that we have 84 maintenance stations statewide. Maintenance stations include such urban stations like the one in the middle of Anchorage that takes care of most of the Anchorage area out to Girdwood, to seven maintenance stations on the Dalton Highway. The maintenance stations on the Dalton Highway are camp stations. The employees go there and work 7 days on and 7 days off, and the shift rotates that way. The dots you see out in western Alaska that don't appear to be connected to any highway, those include places like Galena, Bethel, where they're not on a highway route, but they're there responsible for a major airport installation. Also within the department, under the highway and facilities side, is the harbors division. The state presently has 29 state-owned harbors, and 12 of which are operated by agreement with local governments. We've had a very aggressive program in the last 4 or 5 years to dispose of these harbors to the local governments where possible, and these disposal actions have usually come with a source of money, general fund source or bond money, to take care of deferred maintenance in these harbor facilities. And transfer to the local governments. In the harbor section, we are responsible for 24 of 99 public harbor facilities in the state. And like I said earlier, 12 of these facilities are operated by local governments. The balance of those facilities that aren't operated by local governments are places where there is no local government to operate. For example, in southeast Alaska, you've got Thunder Bay and Elfin Cove and other places like that were originally established years ago as refuge floats or floats for the commercial fishing community that are still there, but there's no local government to transfer them to. Also in the harbor program, we've got a capital program which works with local governments and the Corps of Engineers for major harbor infrastructure improvements. In the Corps of Engineers program, it's the Corps' responsibility to construct the breakwaters and build the harbor basins, and it becomes the state and the local government's responsibility to build and maintain the floats in those harbor basins.
We have a question from Senator Cowdery.
You say on the operated by the 12 facilities operated by the local government, do they collect fees? Does the local government collect the fees for that operation, or does it go to DOT? How's that work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cowdery, the maintenance agreements or the operating agreements we do have with those local governments is that they are responsible for collecting fees to pay for the operation of the harbor and, as the wording is in most of those agreements, to take care of routine maintenance. There have been issues in the past of the responsibility of taking care of major maintenance in those harbors, and typically that has fallen back on the state. But the routine maintenance and operation is covered in the fees in those harbors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, John.
And as I said earlier, there's been a very aggressive program in the last, at the very least, in the last 4 years for transferring many of these harbors to the local governments. And you can see that since 1986, 71 state harbors have been transferred to local governments. And we are in the process. There was a bill last year, a municipal harbor matching grant program passed by the legislature to provide a matching grant for harbor improvements to municipal governments for harbor operating entities. And we're in the process of developing the grant program rules as well as the regulations to administer that so that when and if it is funded by the legislature, we can dispense matching grants to communities to do harbor improvements. Another...
excuse me, we have a question for you. Representative Newman? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, last, with the initiative that was passed this last fall that has to deal with a head tax on the cruise line industry, part of that, is any of that money going to go to support the harbors, or do you have any idea how that is going to work out? Have you, is there been any discussion on that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, to the best of my knowledge, none of that is going to be directed to support the harbors, although I can think of a number of areas in DOT where some of that money, basically a tourism fee, would be appropriate for use by the department. Some of the harbors is a very appropriate use for it, but probably even more appropriate would be there are a number of waysides that along our highways that the department spends a significant amount of money maintaining in the summer, emptying dumpsters, porta potties, and that sort of thing, and that comes out of our operating budget. These waysides were often built in coordination and cooperation with DNR, and yet there's no long-term operating stream for taking care of them. So we have difficulties at times in our budget taking care of them, and it's, you know, it's a shame when you drive down a highway and you see overflowing dumpsters and porta potties that haven't been or vault toilets that have not been serviced in a reasonable amount of time. But that's strictly a budgetary issue.
Go ahead, Representative Newman. You have
thank you, Mr.
Up.
Chair. And John, I was going to bring it up a little bit later. I've got on my notes here to talk about waysides. And the appropriateness to waysides, I feel, you know, is to allow people a chance to pull off the highway, you know, on the Parks Highway from all the way from Wasilla to Fairbanks. It gets a tremendous amount of backup between tourists who do want to look at Alaska. And I can't blame them. It's a beautiful country. But it caused a lot of angst, you know, for people in a hurry. Accidents happen. People with fatigue to be able to pull off. That's a major trucking route. On waysides, but what mechanism is in place? I know that there's some in my community, like at Sunshine, where the community would like to be more involved with the operations of that and volunteering cleanup operations with some of the local youth groups. They would like to help participate in that. Is there a mechanism set up with DOT to allow for that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, actually there is in our policy and procedures, we do have what's called the Adopt a Highway Program. You've probably seen the signs along the road. They're blue, according to the regulations, and it is an Adopt a Highway where organizations can take over a stretch of the highway and do litter pickup and other routine maintenance like that.
I've been cleaning the stretch of the highway for 7 years now.
Yeah. So if you know an organization that is interested in doing that, I don't see why we couldn't extend that to an Adopt a Wayside program without changing the signs. A wayside is part of the highway.
Thank you.
And actually, I do get contacted probably 4 or 5 times a year from organizations that are interested in taking over a piece of highway.
Well, if I may, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
Our soil and conservation districts are very active in some of those programs. Again, with working with our youth programs. Mm-hmm. Through the school, through the water and soil conservation districts, and anything that I can do to help you get that going, please work with me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding of the tax money on the head tax, that it had to be used for development of infrastructure, et cetera. Could we justify using some of that money to do just what you've said, the wayside? Does that fall within the federal mandate for imposing that kind of tax?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I can't answer that one. I'm not that familiar with what the initiative was, other than the dollar amount and a couple of other aspects. Certainly there's a big difference between the capital side, which would be the development, and where our pressing need is on the operating side for keeping them up.
Mr. Chairman, I'd encourage you to look into that, because if there's a way we can use some of that money for that, I think that's well spent.
I definitely will.
Thank you.
Back to the presentation. One of the other areas that most people don't recognize in being part of the Department of Transportation is measurement standards and commercial vehicle enforcement. This actually came to the department in the past from commercial vehicle enforcement, came over from public safety, and measurement standards, often called weights and measures, came over from the Department of Commerce. You go to the supermarket and you weigh some vegetables on a scale. It's got a sticker on it that says it has been certified as being accurate. That's our division that certifies those scales in the state, as well as gas pumps. They've been measured for accuracy so that when you buy 10 gallons of gas, you know you're getting 10 gallons of gas. This division also enforces all federal and state commercial vehicle laws so that we know that when the trucks are on these big commercial trucks are on the highway, that they pass safety inspections on a regular basis. It issues permits for overweight vehicles, a very busy part of the department. Anytime you see a truck going down the road or a big trailer, typically that truck has been given some kind of a permit from the department, from this division, for being either over width or overweight to travel on the roads, and it's escorted by pilot cars. This is a big part of the department in its importance, even though it's a very small division, because a lot of those overweight loads can hit a bridge and damage the bridge so that it's no longer passable. And you take a bridge out of one of our highway sections and you've closed the highway. They've worked for the last few years to implement a one-stop web-based permitting system so that now the trucking company does not need to go to the office, into our office, and fill out the forms and wait for approval on that. They can do it on the line. The approval usually comes in very quickly unless there's some problem with the size or the weight of the load. And it's been a very successful program with the trucking industry. We have a very cooperative relationship with them. In fact, we met last week with the Alaska Trucking Association and had a great meeting with them. We also worked with the Trucking Association last year to increase penalties for overweight vehicles. In the past, overweight vehicle penalties were assessed basically so many pennies per pound overweight. And we worked with them to change that assessment from a straight pennies per pound to a graduated, so that if you're only over 1,000 pounds, which, you know, snow buildup on the undercarriage can more than get you overweight by 1,000 pounds. But it was a graduated scale, so that a small overweight was a very minor infraction to a very significant fee if you were way overweight. And that was a cooperative effort between the department and the Trucking Association, where we both agreed on the method of assessment and the amount of fees. I know this isn't about aviation, but the department, it's hard to extricate various areas from it. And under the maintenance and operations part of the department is the maintenance of 258 state-owned airports. These state airports have a $200 million federally funded AIP capital budget, but most of these airports, these dots you see out there that are off the eroded system, that's the lifeline for the community to get to the rest of the state. Without the operation of that airport, commerce wouldn't occur there. We strive for 24/7 operation of these airports for emergency access for these communities. A little more on the airport. Alaska is the largest airport operator in the United States. We have, like I said, 258 the state-owned and operated airports and two international airports, Anchorage and Fairbanks International. And of those, all those airports, 21 are rural certificated airports and 235 are community airports. For your information, a rural certificated airport is something like Bethel or Nome, where they're rated for a certain type of aircraft. And certain aircraft can't land in some of the more rural airports. To let you know that of all these rural airports we have there are 134 of them that we have a maintenance presence in, but it's not department employees. We contract with communities, with businesses in those rural airports to do the annual maintenance. The cost of that annual maintenance, as you see, is about $3 million per total, an average cost of $27,000 per rural airport. So some people may say that there is no DOT in this community. Well, there is, but it's through contract. You saw the map of the state that showed how the state was divided up into regions. This pie chart shows you how our operating budget, our highway and aviation maintenance funding, is divided up among regions. The lion's share of it is northern region because that's very geographically spread out. It covers some of the significant mileage of the Parks Highway, the Richardson Highway, and the Dalton Highway. Takes a lot to take care of those roads to keep them clear of snow and ice in the wintertime. Maintenance funding in the department, that lower white line, and I apologize, the upper one that's kind of a magenta color doesn't show up that well. The lower white line shows maintenance funding for the department has been fairly flat since 1983. It's only been the last couple of years that the legislature was generous enough to increase our funding level to take care of the maintenance of the department. And you see the magenta line is that if you took the 1983 numbers and adjusted them for inflation, where we would be on the cost of highway maintenance. We've been able to maintain things, to take care of things through a variety of measures, largely in efficiencies, even though the number of highway miles has increased, the number of highway lights and traffic signals, all of which are part of the maintenance cost, have increased in the last 25 years, largely through efficiencies. The equipment we use is much better. The average plow truck is a 10-yard truck with a front blade and a belly blade and oftentimes a wing blade. So one truck is doing a lot more now than it was doing 20 years ago. One of the other things that we've been able to do in the last 20-some years is our general fund maintenance budget is largely for the winter maintenance of the roads. That's where most of our general fund effort goes into. In the summertime, we've been able to shift over a lot of those maintenance efforts onto the federal program where they're doing crack sealing and brush cutting and chip sealing and that sort of thing. So instead of being on the general fund side of the ledger, we've been able to utilize federal maintenance funds for those maintenance crews. That's had a number of advantages, not the least of which is that it allows those trained plow operators and operators who are so important in the winter months to stay employed over the summer months so that we don't have to lose them to other jobs and try and rehire them in the fall. That's a very important feature that we have and something that we need to protect. This shows you the dollar amounts that we've been able to use on the federal program. Roughly $50 million on the highway side for pavement refurbishment and preventative maintenance, and on the aviation side, a $4 million side for all those rural airports that we take care of.
Oh, excuse me. I have a question here from Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, when we're looking at this chart, is this money, is this the state's proportion, or is this the total state and federal money that's going into that?
Representative, this chart here? Is that the one?
No, page 15 of the on maintenance for federal highway maintenance programs.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, this is mostly the federal side of it.
So 90% or large percentage of this is money that you're able to leverage because you have the state funds to work with that. So that's very efficient.
Yeah. I We threw in this next chart because this is something that we actually...
excuse me, just for a second. I want to recognize a couple of, just for the record, that Senator Wilkin has joined us and Representative Johnson. Anybody else? Oh, Representative Coring, I'm sorry. Representative Coring, thank you for being here. Sorry, John, go ahead, please.
One of the things that we get hit with on occasion are the disasters that occur. You know, in 2002, we had the earthquake off the Denali Highway. In that same year, we had a couple of fall floods on the Kenai Peninsula that wreaked havoc. This year, we had a couple of events. We had a very strong heavy rainstorm in Matsu Borough in August, I believe. And in the fall, we had some floods on the Richardson Highway, Seward, Valdez, and up the Richardson Highway. These kind of disasters, when they do hit us, we have to be able to respond immediately. And the first response that occurs is with our M&O forces, because they're out there. And once they respond and start doing the first response on things, we have the ability and the mechanisms to very quickly get contractors on board, oftentimes within 24 hours, to start effecting some of the more permanent repairs. I know this happened in Matsu on the Parks Highway. We lost two bridges. Let me restate that. We lost the approaches to two bridges, and the Parks Highway was closed. We had contractors under contract within 36 hours, and they were hauling rock from the Seward Highway south of Anchorage all the way up to the Parks Highway north of Wasilla to reinforce the riverbanks and rebuild the approaches to these bridges, and within a couple of days we had the road open. So it's very important that we have our own forces there for the first response, but able to get the contractors under contract to take care of the immediate repairs.
Excuse me, Senator Olson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McKinnon, could you tell me why there was $600,000 spent on the Hooper Bay fire from the DOT under disasters?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, Hooper Bay, the freight that comes into Hooper Bay comes on the shoreline outboard of the airport, and there's a road from that point to the town. The road was in very poor shape, and we were directed to beef up the road, get a good surface on it, so that the amount of freight and components for the housing and school that were destroyed could transit to the town.
I just want to thank you as a senator from that district for sticking up to the plate. One other question, Mr. Chairman, if I could, and has to do with, you made a comment there was 258 airports that are out there, and the state maintains a presence in many of these airports, and I can understand that if you've got a runway out there, you've got people that are there to go ahead and have a grader or some type of heavy equipment to do it. Are you counting those airports as well that do not have a surface runway, and are just dependent on float plane traffic, such as Angoon, where the chairman comes from?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, actually Angoon is counted as one of our airports because it's got a float plane facility there. And there are a number of them in Southeast Alaska and other coastal communities where that float plane facility is counted as part of our airport inventory.
So if there's a complaint about the float that's there, we come to you and say that, you know, the float that whatever town it happens to be needs to be upgraded or needs to be taken care of before somebody has some damage.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead, John.
As part of the department, we have a construction side that provides construction oversight of all Department of Transportation projects. And the construction consists of our contract administration, field inspection and oversight, and quality assurance. Our construction program is again under the highway section underneath me is construction not only of highways and ferries, which you can see we have 190 active projects with a current active value of over $1 billion, 89 active aviation projects with a little over half $1 billion in current active value, reimbursable programs. on our facilities side, we've got the statutory authority to do manage and construct buildings for all state agencies. And we did API for mental health. We did the food lab for DEC recently, and we're in the process of doing a virology lab for Department of Health and Social Services up on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus right now. This is the reimbursable side. And then we've got a Harbors program where we work with communities and the Corps of Engineers Harbor program. So at any one time, we have a lot of work going on in the department. Just a little tidbit of fact is our combined operating capital budget is roughly $2 billion.
Excuse me, Representative Newman has a question for you.
Thank you, Chair. John, when you're talking about the capital budget now, does that include money, or can you talk a little bit about the proactive approach DOT has implemented to, in concern of some of our bridge improvements, to make sure that they can handle the weight that will, when we start building a natural gas pipeline, I know a lot of our bridges need to be upgraded. Are you putting money towards that now, or if a gas pipeline is approved, are you going to come back to the legislature and say we need a whole lot more money right now to make sure these bridges can handle the weight to haul the pipe?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, we are doing that now. There are a couple of bridges in northern region. We've gone through the inventory on the routes, whether it's the Parks Highway, the Richardson Highway, the Dalton Highway, and we've identified all the weak links we have, and we're starting from the weakest link and working backwards from that. So that you take like Washington Creek Bridge north of Fairbanks, you take care of that, and you've upped your weight limits that you can handle. And so we're starting from the weakest ones and working beyond that. And it's interesting that you mentioned being ready for the gas line. One of the things that we were able to do 3 years ago was to increase our maintenance efforts on the Dalton Highway. The Dalton Highway is a 400 and some mile route that stretches north of Fairbanks all the way to Prudhoe Bay, and it really is the lifeline to Alaskan's economy, because all the freight that comes to the North Slope to keep that oil field pumping, it travels on the Dalton Highway. And for any of you that have ever been on, and I know there are a few of you that have, it's in horrible shape. The maintenance effort that we were allowed to do for the last 20 years was not even keeping up. But the legislature was very generous in their funding for the last couple of years, and have given us not only increased operating funds, but increased maintenance funds to take care of some of the surface problems we have there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Salmon.
Yes. The question I guess the governor asked for a 10% cut, and up in the northern region, he's asking for a $6 million cut, and they're thinking about cutting the Taylor Highway maintenance program. Have you heard anything about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salmon, of that $150 million in proposed cuts, the department's share was $21.3 million. We offered up a wide variety of cuts from all the regions and all the modes. And at this point, those proposed cuts are still being vetted by the administration. And you know, I really don't think I'm at liberty to discuss which ones have been offered and which ones will be accepted.
So you're not going to tell us the secret then of what's coming? That first line, the $1.182 billion, highways and ferries, 190 projects. You don't have to do it now, but can you break that out between highways and ferries off the top of your head, or provide that to the committee at some point?
Representative Johansson, I can get a breakdown of those for you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, John.
One of the things I'd also like to talk about is for the last 2 years, you know, the price of oil has been good, the state budget's been good, and the legislature's also been very generous in a state-funded construction program for a variety of transportation projects. And just last year alone, this totaled, almost $170 million, some right there, and it included projects like Big Lake and Burma Road Design and EIS in Mat-Su. I mentioned earlier, Dalton Highway heavy maintenance, that was $9 million for surfacing. We hope to continue that over a couple of more years. I think we identified on the Dalton Highway alone that if we had a 5 or 6 year program of around $9 million a year, we could take care of a lot of those road issues we have there. It included the Juneau Access, Palmer-Wasilla Highway. Those of you from Mat-Su, Representative Newman, I know you're very familiar with this, and Representative Coring. That's a critical link in Mat-Su that's way behind the curve in getting reconstructed. That's one that we pretty much identified the best way to deal with that one was as a general funded project. We've gotten funds, I think a total of $18 million over the last couple of years, and that one we're proposing this year to do a number of intersection improvements on that one. We've got another program that's called the Parks Highway Weight Restriction Relief. Parks Highway is where most of the freight between South Central and Fairbanks travels, and in the springtime during breakup, quite often the weight restrictions go down to 85% of the maximum legal load. This causes a burden on the trucking industry because they've got to take their containers, which are shipped full from down south, and they've got to break them down when they get to Anchorage and take 15 to 20% of the weight out of some of those containers. And it adds considerable to the expense of shipping to the interior. So we've got a program that has identified a number of projects over the next half a dozen years where if we did this project and get them all completed, we can eliminate the seasonal weight restrictions on the Parks Highway. Roads to Resource Program, there are numerous small projects that is funded to take care of transportation issues that affect small and large resource operations. We partnered with the Department of Natural Resources Forestry Division on a road in the Ketchikan area that accessed both a state and a federal timber sale area that is helping to keep the couple of sawmills in the Ketchikan area alive.
Senator Cowdery has a comment or question.
Yeah, 2 years ago we working on the weight restrictions, and there was some tests done by the University of Alaska on the north and south lanes on the slope, and they found out that the southbound lanes had more damage due to the bounce of the empty trailers than the northbound lanes with full loads. Mm-hmm. And so out of that, I think we came to an agreement on weight restrictions and speed limits to get that down. Is that going to be maintained the same as we had in the past as far as speed limits and doing the breakup area at times?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cowdery, I'm not familiar with that, but you know our goal is to get rid of the seasonal weight restriction completely.
Mine too.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, John.
And as part of the program funded last year, which was a continuation of the previous year, also was a congestion initiative in the Anchorage area. And what we have starting construction this summer is going to be the Glen Burgaw Interchange, a design-build project. And what we got funded last year in the 07 capital budget is an extension of Dowling Road to the west and Boniface Parkway extension, 48th Avenue. This next chart shows you some historical construction expenditures for both the marine highways, highways, and aviation. And as you can see by the slope of that graph, it's been ratcheting up very well every year. This is both Federal Highway Administration and the aviation side. Our aviation program in the last 4 or 5 years grew significantly. This does not show the state-funded program for the last 2 years. This next one, I'm going to briefly go over the statewide transportation improvement program. If you have any really technical questions, I've got Jeff Otteson here who knows these in detail and could confuse all of us with his answer if he really wanted to answer those the really detailed questions. But the STIP, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, is a required listing of plan project activity for all federally funded highway construction projects. It's the state's plan. It's not the department's plan. It goes through a very significant and extensive public process for review of the projects that we have out there. It's a four-year STIP. It gets renewed every 4 years, but it goes through a continuous process of amendment because as projects increase in cost and budget, and we have to continually amend the plan. The selection criteria can be gotten at that website there. One of the things that we do when we put the STIP together and amendment, we follow the regulations. We don't have a lot of discretion in what comes and goes on the STIP. And when we do get the STIP finally approved after public process, it has to go to the Federal Highway Administration for approval, as well as the Federal Transit Administration for approval. And the STIP has a number of funding criteria in it. We talked earlier about the National Highway System. And like I said, those are federally defined routes. There are over 2,000 centerline miles. It's 15% of the centerline miles in the state carry 43% of the vehicles in the state. They're very important routes. It includes the Marine Highway System, boats and terminals. And just a note, it is, in our estimation, underfunded. We have a lot more work on the NHS that we should do that we don't have the funds to do. That's why it's very important that the legislature in the last couple of years has included in its capital budget projects, capital money for projects on that, state funded.
I know we did the Marine Highways last week, so I don't want to get too deep into it, but can you just elaborate a little bit more about how the vessels or do the routes figure into the funding formula, or how does that enter into the NHS funding? It says most AMHS vessels and terminals, so.
Yes, I might turn this over to Jeff to answer this particular one. I could, but I think he'd probably give a more.
We don't have to get too detailed, I just.
Okay, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development. The vessels of the Marine Highway System and the terminals of the system that are connected to a National Highway System highway are considered part of the National Highway System for funding reasons. They don't earn any revenue to the state. In other words, our share of the NHS program nationally is determined by things like the number of miles we have. So our vessels aren't actually earning us dollars, but they are eligible to spend those dollars. And in fact, over the life of the state, that has been a big part of the funding stream for ferries and terminals.
Thanks.
Great. Yeah. The next category, the Alaska Highway System, gets 1,500 centerline miles. It's high-level roads, but don't quite meet the federal standards for NHS. One that you may have heard about, the Community Transportation Program. It's an Alaska category that covers all eligible roads that aren't in the AHS or the NHS. It's essentially every public road in the state that is neither NHS or AHS. Alaska's has a unique ability to use federal funds on just about any road in the state, whether it's maintained and owned by the state or local governments. That's great for local governments. It affects our ability to maintain and the NHS and NHS routes. In Alaska, the state owns a proportionally large share of this, but there's over 10,000 centerline miles of CTP roads. That's a big piece. Most of your rural roads and communities that we do some work on at times, those are CTP projects. You're familiar with AMATs and FMATs, the MPOs. Their funding comes out of the CTP category. The last category I want to talk about is called TRAC, or Trails and Recreational Access for Alaskans. That pays for a lot of bike paths, waysides in some areas, transportation enhancements, landscaping, and sometimes historic renovations in some areas. This pie chart really shows the distribution of federal highway funds in the various categories. You see a big chunk of it, 48% of the federal funds does go to the NHS. But what I wanted to use this to illustrate was that 39% that goes into the Community Transportation Program, that quite often mostly goes to local roads, community roads, 26.7% of that is by regulation goes to the MPO in Anchorage, the AMATS, and 8.7% of that goes to the Fairbanks MPO. We presently only have two MPOs, or municipal planning organizations, in the state, but we expect that in the next couple of years there will be a third one that's designated, and that would probably encompass the Matsu area.
I have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are these percentages mandated by the feds?
Through the chair,
specifically the 2% for the trails and access and stuff.
That's in our statute.
That's in Alaska statute, not
yes.
Federal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We're presently going through a major amendment of the STIP, and it's going to be called the 2006 to 2009 STIP. We've been working on the 2006 to 2008. It's the highway reauthorization called Safety Lou. It delivered the highest total funds that we've ever received in the past. However, there's a number of quirks about it that's resulted in less funding for ordinary projects because of a variety of things. Deductive earmarks was a big one. A significant amount of the highway reauthorization included earmarks that were deductive from our normal formula funds. These earmarks were requested by communities and organizations for projects they had in mind, but they largely came out of formula funds, and that has restricted our ability and our flexibility of using these on other projects. Earmarks are something that we Congress loves them, and communities love them, but they cause problems in the department, again, in our flexibility of able to use the funds for things. We have a couple of what we refer to as problem earmarks that we're hoping that will be taken care of in the budget this year. These are earmarks that are not able to be used for their intended purpose because of the wording of the earmark. And we're working on a swap of general fund for these earmarks to allow the intended recipient of that earmark to take advantage of the earmark, yet the federal fund side comes to the department. So we'll be discussing it probably with these committees again at some point when we get into the capital budget about those earmark swaps.
Representative Johansson.
I just wanted to make sure I understood the earmarks. You mentioned Congress loves them. I think these earmarks were specifically picked by our delegation back east as their obvious priorities for these projects. So
that's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Johansson, one of the problems that earmarks cause is that quite often they don't fully fund a project. It's not unusual for an earmark just to result in a design study and identify the need for many, many millions more to complete the project. And it can oftentimes create an expectation of more funds to follow, and that's not usually the case. Just an editorial comment there.
How long is the shelf life on plans for a road? Say, you know, you could design something for 10 years ago, it wouldn't fit today. What's your average shelf life on?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cowdery, the shelf life depends on, to a certain extent, on what we've had to do as far as NEPA to get those plans done. If an EIS is required for a project, that EIS has got a shelf life of 5 years. If nothing is done on the project for 5 years, and then you start the project up again or get into a construction phase, quite often you'll have to go back and do a supplemental EIS, which can be a minor affair or can be a significant amount of work. It's best that when you get into the NEPA phase of a project that you're pretty much committed to carrying it out.
Thank you.
Um, One of the problems we have in 2007 is that we're still waiting for a transportation appropriations bill in Congress. We've been told that sometime mid-February, which I believe is mid-February now, that we're going to get a transportation appropriations. It hasn't happened yet, but until then we're operating under a continuing resolution which has limited the amount of funding available for 2007. So we're developing a draft STIP right now, which is based on a continuing resolution number, and we're hoping that an appropriations bill will get some clarification on what our actual funding is going to be. One of the things that we're looking to in 2009 is that's the expiration of the current safety lieu authorization, and that it's very likely there's going to be some insolvency in the Highway Trust Fund. As you're probably aware, the Highway Trust Fund is a federal fund that comes from the gas taxes you pay at the federal level on every gallon of gas you buy. And there's some estimations that trust fund is going to be insolvent in 2009, and there may be an adjustment there. So we're not looking forward to that, but we're kind of bracing ourselves should it occur. Off the STIP and back into the department's operating budget. This is our operating budget by fund source. Total request of operating budget is $544 million. The lion's share of that, a good piece of that, is the general fund support. That general fund support is pretty much evenly divided between the highway and aviation side and the marine highway side. We also have, as you go around that circle, the interagency receipts. We have what's called the Highway Working Capital Fund. That's where we pay for the equipment that we use and put money into a fund to pay for its replacement when that equipment wears out. International Airport Revenue Funds, that funds the operation of the Anchorage International Airport and the Fairbanks International Airport. Capital Improvement Program receipts. Alaska Marine Highway Fund. Marine Highway Fund is the ticket sales off the marine highways, and then some smaller receipts in there. But the total budgetary.
Go ahead.
Total budgetary request of $544 million.
Thank you, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, is there a gas tax in Alaska, and if so, how does it get distributed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, yes, there's a motor fuel tax in Alaska, both for the highway side. There's one for the marine side for when you go to a marine fueler and get gas for your outboard motor. And there's an aviation gas tax, too. I'm most familiar with the highway gas tax. It's 8 cents a gallon. It generates a little over $30 million a year, which goes into the general fund. It's not a dedicated tax. We have a constitutional prohibition against dedicated taxes in the state. The 8 cent a gallon gas tax was originally put in place in 1963 at 8 cents a gallon. Hasn't changed since then. And I've been told that when it was put in 1963, it was the highest gas tax in the country. It's presently the lowest gas tax in the country. I believe the national average is 25 to 26 cents a gallon.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
And is there a federal highway tax, gasoline tax, too, that is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
The price of gasoline that we get?
Yes, I believe about 18 cents a gallon of when you buy a gallon of gas is the federal share.
And. Wow. Yeah. Do we see that in the program receipts? Is that where that's included in that?
That is not in our program receipts. The gas tax is not. State gas tax goes into the general fund. Federal gas tax goes to Washington, D.C., and it comes back to us as Federal Highway Administration, our highway construction program.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Our general fund request by function in the department, our general fund request in FY08 is almost $236 million, and it's broken down by function. Most of it goes into our highway and aviation maintenance and operations. That's the money we spend plowing the roads in the winter, taking care of the 235-some airports, actually 248 airports we have, and and other routine maintenance. The next piece of it is the Marine Highway System. The $98.1 million is the general fund subsidy for the Marine Highway System. You had that discussion last week. $10.2 million goes into the administrative costs for the departments. We've got some going to the planning functions. We discuss measurement standards, commercial vehicle enforcement, roughly $2.5 million operating cost. Facilities, 14.4. The department does have over 700 buildings statewide in its facilities division. These buildings range anywhere from the Central Region Office Building in Anchorage, often also known as the Upside Down Building on International Airport Way, to generator sheds at rural airports and snow removal equipment buildings, very small unheated buildings that house equipment, but they're part of the 700 some facilities that the department does operate. We also have a $4.7 million in the design and construction division of the department. That's the non-federally funded portion of all of our highway construction and design work we do.
Representative Johnson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is any of this $235 million used to leverage any federal money, or is this straight our ticket?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that is not leveraged money. Our leveraged money is in the capital budget as our highway and aviation match funds. Approximately a little over 9% of the leverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Accomplishments of the department. We keep the roads in really good shape. We've got in 2005 we did a public opinion survey of just to get an idea from the public on how they thought the department was doing, and we had over an 80% approval rating from the general public on how they felt the department was doing their job. What I'd like to point out, though, is that in the last couple of years, we've had a 20% reduction in highway fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. 6% decrease in the number of state-owned bridges that are considered deficient by Federal Highway Administration standards. Last year, the legislature passed a voluntary primary seatbelt law, and in the last few years, we've seen an increase in the percentage of people wearing seatbelts, and that translates directly into a reduction in fatalities on the highways.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Is the department seeing any increased costs because of melting permafrost, global warming?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, I'd love to show you some photos of some of our roller coaster roads we have. Yes, we do have problems with permafrost melting in areas. Whether it is increasing, but it's something that we've been dealing with for decades in the state. We have when you build highways on permafrost, you get differential melting in areas, and it definitely caused us to put a lot of reconstruction effort into them.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
Do you have any kind of an estimate on how much this is costing the state?
Senator Wilikowski, I don't have an estimate off the top of my head, but I can get you some numbers. Again, I want to get back into the accomplishments and on the safety side of it. There's a reason why the highway reauthorization bill was called Safety Lou, and it's because one of the primary focuses of reauthorization was on making our highways safe. It's been a goal of the Secretary of Transportation at the federal level, and it's also a goal of the state is to improve highway safety. 4 years ago, we were killing 100 people a year on the state highways. We're down in the low 70s right now, and I think that's a major accomplishment in this state. We're down in the low 70s because of things like seatbelt laws and people wearing seatbelts when they should. We're there because of better enforcement on the roads by public safety. Last year we got a bill passed that allows us to designate dangerous stretches of road as safety corridors, where the traffic fines for violations on those stretches of road are double fines. You hit people in the pocketbook and they catch on very quickly. A couple of things like that have made a big difference. We've also used some of our federal funding on the on one side to aid public safety in DUI patrols. We finance Department of Public Safety to add more officers in areas where there are DUI problems, and they put extra officers on the road, increased enforcement for DUI, they catch more drunk drivers. It's been a very effective program. We have DUI patrols in Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and we're working on one in the Kenai Peninsula area. One of the other things, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, that one of the other things that I believe has contributed to lower fatalities on the highway has been an increased effort on the maintenance side. I firmly believe that the department does a very good job in the winter of keeping our roads as free as possible of ice and other dangerous driving conditions, whether it's through the application of sand and gravel on the roads for abrasives, or one of the other measures we've done is getting out ahead of a snowfall and applying de-icing chemicals, magnesium chloride. You do that to the intersections and the snow doesn't stick, so that when you are able to get out and clear the roads off, you get bare pavement a lot quicker than you would otherwise. Our maintenance and operation crews covered over 1,300 lane miles of highways with crack sealers to prevent the water from getting in and eroding your roadbed. And re-leveled depressed roadway surfaces by banding them. We paved over 21 centerline miles of gravel roads. We have good programs with many communities on pave and trade when we can afford to do that, and when we can identify roads that communities would take over in exchange for being paved. Statewide, we've repaved 165 centerline miles of roads and built 7.9 centerline miles of new roads.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. John, I know that the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been very proactive in helping design and construction of roads, all the way from trying to keep roadbeds frozen in areas where there's permafrost. I know that we've been able to leverage some federal funds for the rubberized materials and chip seal programs that I've seen physically, myself, that these roads are in very good shape. Could you talk to us a little bit about some of the other things that DOT is doing to help decrease our costs? We have a lot of excess material and trying to reuse some programs, a recycling program per se. And some of the things that I've heard about is using glass and roads and, again, more rubberizing materials. You talk a little bit about what the state's doing to be proactive in those areas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I'll take a stab at it. You've probably seen milling machines on the road where they actually, instead of overlaying the entire road, they'll go through and just grind down the traveling surface in the lane itself, and then fill in that. When you do a project, you're paying for asphalt by the ton that's in place. And so if you only need to do that portion of the road that's worn down, then you're paying for a lot less tonnage of asphalt. So we're able to stretch those dollars as best we can by only paving that portion of the road that's worn down. One of the other areas that we're looking at in paving is because of the wear of studded tires on roads, and studded tires do increase the wear over conventional tires on the road. In some areas, we import an extremely hard aggregate to put down on the road as part of the asphalt that is much more resistant to the wear of the studded tires. It can actually, in cases we estimate, I would say almost triple the life of the road, but at least double the life of the paving service. We did a program last year on Tudor Road in Anchorage where we used hard aggregate there. The problem we have in hard aggregate is that most of the aggregate in Alaska is alluvial sources, and it's not a hard aggregate. We've imported some. There's a hard aggregate source near Haines. The DuPont pit in Puget Sound is a very hard aggregate, and we're working to develop a quarry site about 25 miles out on the Denali Highway that's also a hard aggregate. Transportation costs to get it to where you're doing the paving are going to be high, but if you can double the life of the pavement, it's a worthwhile investment.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. And John, you mentioned hard aggregates, and I know that some of the mining companies, there's one in my district now that's starting up, or a lot of their gold is encapsulated in granite. And I know that, you know, as they're mining that, they're fracturing that down, you know, where you've got the requirement to D1, you know, with a certain amount of fractured edges and sharp edges for binding. You know, are you working actively with other gold mines or other mining operations to use maybe some of their more hard materials like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I used to think granite was one of the hardest rocks there are, but it's from what I've learned that they're you know, it's about halfway out on the hardness scale of what we'd like to use. We are working with I think this is near district the Lucky Shot mine on Hatcher Pass. We need to do some improvements to the surface of the road up there, and we're in discussion with them about them providing the materials since they have a lot of excess rock up there in their operation. And we'll crush it and spread it on the road.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The department challenges, and you'll hear this over and over again, recruiting and retaining and retaining staff. That is one of our big challenges. We're a department of engineers, and the colleges in this country are not producing as many engineers as they used to. And we have a difficult time getting them. The state government doesn't pay competitive wages with federal government, doesn't pay competitive wages with private sector. And again, that makes it difficult for us to recruit staff. And on the retaining side of it, like many state agencies, the Department of Transportation grew in the early 80s. And we've got a large percentage of our department that's eligible or nearly eligible for retirement in the next half a dozen years. And so we run the possibility of losing a lot of those. And it's not just on the engineering side of things. It affects every place in the department. Our maintenance and operation crews, these people can go make more money working construction in the summer, so why should they work year-round doing highway maintenance? It's a challenge we have ahead of us. One of the other challenges we have, I mentioned earlier in talking about the STIP, is the lack of the federal fiscal year 07 appropriations bill for transportation. Operating under a continuing resolution is there's a lot of uncertainty in that. It's our job to preserve and protect Alaska's infrastructure, and that's a challenge because of the funding aspect of it. We've got a number of major transportation projects that are on the drawing board in the discussion, and we're trying to implement those. We're dealing with the configuration of the Rain Highway system. The presentation you heard last week made it fairly clear that the system was, you know, it's was built on a 40-year-old model, and we're trying to adopt to what the new model of that system needs to be. And then we all have to deal with high inflation. Some of the costs of construction projects for certain components of these projects are coming in a lot higher than we thought. This is much more serious in rural Alaska and difficult in rural Alaska than it is in urban Alaska. And the last slide is one of the best slides of the presentation. It's any more questions?
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. And I realize I've certainly had my share of questions here today already. But something that it's often been a question to myself. And I grew up in Wisconsin where, this is a real safety issue to me. And signs are indicating along the highway where there's passing zones and no passing zones. And again, in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, there's a lot of snow on the roads. But I think particularly in Alaska where you don't know where it's a safe passing zone. There's a lot of darkness in our winter. There's no indication you can't see the lines on the highway. But it's very advantageous to look down there, and I can still see the yellow signs that say no passing zone or the white ones that say passing zone. And I used to try and impress my kids and say, I can read that sign down there, but just because of the familiarity on that. But it's so advantageous to know if there's a corner, a dip in the road, a major intersection that intersects into the highway, of its passing or no passing zones. Have you ever done a study on what it would cost to do that, or why does not Alaska do that? Because this is a real safety issue in my mind. It would make our roads considerably safer.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, a lot of our sign placement, believe it or not, is federally regulated. Our highways are federally funded, and so we have to comply with the federal fuel rules when it comes to the type of signs we have and the placement of signs. And a lot of the signs that we put out there, those signs that we put out there have to be included in what's called the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. Big word, but simply put, is we can't decide. We don't have the choice of what signs go where. They've got to fit within certain criteria. I think probably more important than placement of signs for traffic for passing zones is the highway markings that are actually on the roads themselves, the paint striping. That's a difficult one in Alaska because we have winter conditions where a lot of times those stripes are obscured by the ice and snow on the road. But even more difficult is those paint markings that we put down in the summer. By the time you've had a half a winter of snowplow action on them, they've worn them off. We've seen the price of that paint double in the last 3 years, and it makes it very difficult for us to adequately stripe those roads where we can, where we need to.
Go ahead and
follow up, Mr. Yeah. Chair. So is there a reason why Alaska cannot participate in a program like that, or is it just cost? Do you know what it would cost?
You know, Representative Newman, I'll have to look into that. I know on the Seward Highway, going over Turnagain Pass, it's where we have center turn passing lanes in there. There are signs there that identify those as passing zones. But as far as the typical two-lane highway, I think your indicator is by the stripes in the road, whether it's a solid line or a dashed line.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Salmon.
Yeah, the question I have is about the runway in Red Devil. They have a big, beautiful state runway there, and there's no lights on it. I'm kind of wondering why would they build an airport and not put lights on there. You know, because I think that's, for medical emergencies, I think that's almost necessary in most of the areas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salmon, I'd have to get back to you on why there are no lights on that. I do know that we have a lot of rural runways that are unlighted presently, and we've got with the support of Senator Stevens, we've got a fairly aggressive program of lighting all of our rural runways. It could be on Red Devil's case is that the reconstruction project came first, and the lighting will come later. But I will get back to you on that one.
Thank you, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. John, could you brief the committee on the issue at Chitna in regard to the reappropriation of the $700,000 because of the washout, just so we know about it?
Okay. 2 years ago, the department got an appropriation of $700,000, and that was to work with the ATNA and the Chitna Native Association to come to terms of providing access across native lands to the Copper River for dip netting. For a variety of reasons, the money was not able to be used, and the operators on the river were able to come to some agreement with the Village Corporation for access at O'Brien Creek. But in the meantime, the floods last year, the rains last year, washed out the bridge at O'Brien Creek and has cut off access for a lot of dip netters to go down the Copper River Highway and do some dip netting, as well as the fact that it's difficult to launch boats there on the Copper River. That dip net fishery gets a tremendous amount of public use there, and we have that $700,000 appropriation. We're not able to use it for the intended purpose. But we've come across two fairly immediate needs where we could use it. One would be to replace the O'Brien Creek Bridge that washed out last fall, not with a bridge wide enough for trucks and that, but we're thinking more along the lines of a bridge wide enough for four-wheelers. That's typically the access that's needed in that area. Copper River Highway is blocked by a slide just down the road from this point. As well as put in a boat launch facility further upstream at the main bridge on the McCarthy Road over the river. So we requested a couple legislators to see if they would assist us in getting those funds reappropriated, and we'd work with DNR on both replacing the bridge and putting the boat launch facility in.
Thank you.
we may be, our offices may be talked about, okay, about that issue, just so it's appropriate we know. Second thing, John, would you tell the committee about the weighing system, the truck weighing system that's I forget the name of it, on the fly, that we're doing, that's part of the federal advanced transportation program or something like that. It's pretty whiz-bang. And
way in motion?
Yeah.
I don't know how it works. There's some kind of magic in these things, but there are a couple of places we have in the Anchorage area right now that are called way in motion, and there are sensors that are put in the pavement. In fact, it's not in asphalt. If you drive on the Seward Highway heading down towards actually, you're still in the Anchorage city limits, but before you get out of the city limits, there are a couple of concrete pads in the road where the rest of the road is asphalt, and it's able to weigh the truck on the fly as the truck goes over. We also have a couple of them on the Parks Highway, or the Glen Highway north of Anchorage. It takes care of the need for all the trucks to stop at every weigh station as they go.
Senator Wilkin?
And doesn't it, if I'm a trucker, and I could take off from Anchorage, and I would, with my barcode on my truck, tell the permit, or tell the state that I'm going to haul X load from Anchorage to Prudhoe Bay, and eliminate, and as long as I stay legal, eliminate any sort of requirement to stop at any weigh station, because we're going to run over that pad, and as long as that measurement reads the barcode on my truck and I'm legal, I don't have to stop at that next weigh station. Isn't that how it works?
That's correct.
So the truckers really like it because you don't have a stack up, particularly in weather conditions, you don't have a backup of trucks sitting waiting to get through weigh stations. And I think the feds paid for that. We were, if I remember, a demo state, but the truckers really like it, and I suspect we'll see more of it just because it's become accepted and they're working the bugs out of it. It's pretty cool. Hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. McKinnon? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McKinnon, I got a number of questions. One has to do with the dust control. What are the plans for that? What has been the latest and developments in that aspect of issue, especially when you don't have pavement, because where I come from, there's a fair amount of industrial work that's being done on the roads and resources, and the complaint that they have is that subsistence users with dry fish on the side of the road, the fish camps are going to be affected with, and nobody wants to eat dusty dry fish. And so what is the latest on dust control and those issues?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I wish there was some new technology that would take care of that. Paving in a lot of rural communities is a very expensive operation, not only on your initial capital costs, but on your long-term operating costs. We continue to experiment with chemicals that you can add to it that do bind moisture into the roadbed and keep the dust down. There are some that have been very successful, but it's not a question of just taking that particular chemical and using it on a roadbed. It depends on what the particulate makeup of the roadbed is. There's one, and I can't for the life of me right now remember what the name of it is, but it works only if there are a lot of fines in it. If it's a fairly coarse roadbed, it's not very effective. No, it isn't. It's a chemical that's applied to it, not unlike calcium chloride that we use in most of our roads. But we continue to work with the university's Transportation Research Institute to come up with some of those admixtures that we can put in the roadbed to keep the dust down.
Another question. Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Is that the main complaint that I've heard from the number of airports that I represent in my Senate district is that these airport vendors are being charged at a dissimilar rate than other vendors are out there. It has to do with some of the airport facilities there in Nome, Kotzebue, Barrow, and if you compare those to the restaurants that are down, either down in Dillingham or up in Bethel, the newer restaurants or eating places have been driven off the airport because of having to pay related to the gross revenues that they're getting, and they're having to go ahead and show their books, which I think is proprietary information to whatever bureaucrat happens to come through to do that. Is there any end in sight, or is this a continued complaint we're going to hear, and so that people are driven off the airport property, so those of us that work at the airport have to drive into town to get some.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think I'd like to refer that question to Senator Torgerson, if he's still here. Okay. What I recall that one being is that the last couple of years we've gone through all of our state airport leases, and when a restaurant is on an airport property, it's part of the airport lease, and try and get them all to the same standard so they're all playing by the same rules. We noticed 4 years ago that depending on what airport you were talking about and how old the lease was, that there were different rules applied to that lease, and it wasn't fair for those that were paying market. It wasn't fair to those that that were paying, well, it wasn't fair to those paying market to those that had an older lease that for whatever reason, there wasn't much revenue involved in it. So the goal was to bring them all up to the same standard so they're all paying by the same set of rules. Those old leases that were being retired and brought up to the current, of course, we're going to get hit with an increase. Again, the goal was just to make it fairly uniform across the state.
And that's mandated by state?
I think that's our internal policy to do that.
Okay. Yes. One other question, Mr. Chairman, and this has to do with a little more provocation here, and that has to do with the Juneau Access Road. What's the department's stance on the Juneau Access Road related to the Marine Highway System? And what are the plans going on now, especially with the idea that the governor has essentially stopped the road that was being punched through between the Gold Belt Ferry and several miles up the way across two bridges?
Okay.
And last night there was a vote, obviously, with the CBJ that had a 5-4 split on it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'd like to refer that answer to that question to Mal Menzies, who's the Southeast Regional Engineer. Reason being is I have a potential conflict of interest with that project, so I've not been involved with it. I could take a stab at the answer, but I think you'd probably get a more accurate answer from somebody who's informed on that.
With all due respect, I was just asking that for another senator, the fellow to my left here.
Would you state Chairman, your name for the record, please?
My name is Malcolm Menzies. I'm the director of the Southeast Region DOT. With regard to your question, at the closing hours of the Governor Murkowski's administration, he directed us to go ahead with a Pioneer Road bid. The Pioneer Road bid was for initially 23 miles of road, which included over 2 miles of bridge. The bids came in relatively high compared to other Pioneer roads that we have bid. Governor Palin, approximately 12 days after the bid came in, ordered us to cancel that bid. That was just for a Pioneer Road, which was in truth a logging road or a single lane access road to give access to future construction of a typical secondary highway, a two-lane federal aid standard highway. We continue to go ahead with the design of that two-lane federal aid highway. We hope to have all our permits in order in April. We hope to bid that project in April, 23 miles of road. We will bid it in three phases, the first 23 miles in three different phases. There'll be two roadway phases of approximately 10 to 11 miles each, and then a separate bridge phase that takes care of two bridges that are approximately 1/2 mile each. There is a total of 7 bridges on that portion of the road.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. As we look at the governor's idea that she's going to be cutting somewhere between $150 and $200 million from the road, how do you envision this being funded? As it almost looks like a new project.
This project is a federal aid project. We do have federal funds for the project. Last year, Senate Finance House gave us $45 million in general funds. The year before that, we received $5 million in general funds. We've used those general funds for the design of the project. We're using those general funds for some procurement of materials on that project. Those procurement of materials will be reimbursed as we put them in the ground or use them for the bridges. The materials we purchased are purchasing right now our piling for the bridges, bridge girders, and culvert pipe conduit. As that material is placed into roadway construction, we will be reimbursed for that.
Representative Johnson? Oh, that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my question about the advance purchase of the materials, and are we going to be able to use those or recoup that? Those aren't lost.
No, sir. No, sir. They are not lost.
Representative Johansson?
You mentioned federal funds as funding source for that Juneau Access Road. Can you be more specific? Is there a certain pot of federal money that you're speaking of? Maybe with an acronym, possibly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, Jeff Otteson in the background is better versed on all the federal funds that we will be used. But there is federal funds on the project within our normal federal procurement for highways. There is also some federal funds that are called shackwack funds that we are using for that roadway. And there are some federal funds for bridge replacement funds or bridge access funds to ferries. Those are the federal funds that I'm talking about. Mr. Otteson knows the percentage better than myself.
Yes, for the record, Jeff Otteson. Basically, Mel has said it. The two main categories that we intend to use were the shackwack program and the bridge program. Bridge program is somewhat unique. The funds for bridges is generally restricted to replacement bridges, that is, not new bridges. But where you are replacing ferry service, you can, in fact, use these funds to substitute for what the ferry was providing. So that's the thinking behind that.
Okay. Can just follow up. You have that. Can you provide me with that language, the federal language, the shackle?
Yes, I can. I can give it to you right out of Title 23.
And if I can switch gears just a minute while we have Malcolm up here. One thing in the transition report that I, this giant document that came out, spoke about Southeast region and there being kind of a morale problem because of a lot of these high profile projects that you've been dealing with over the last couple of years, so Juneau Access, and you guys talk a lot about bridges today, but you're talking about small bridges. Smaller bridges, but you know, these two things brought a lot of attention to Southeast region, and according to the transition report, many of the people that work under you, many of the classified people, I guess from what I gather, are not exactly too happy about certain projects being pursued, and you know. When I worked over the summer going to college, worked for a guy named Ralph Bartholomew, and if you're familiar with our bridge, you know that name very well. You know, when we got up in the morning and went into the warehouse, we didn't get to pick and choose which projects. We were, you know, we had our bosses, and they gave us marching orders. It was a moving company and transportation company. And if I could pick every morning which move I went on, it would be the one without the piano and the freezer and all that sort of stuff. And I brought this up at the Marine Highway briefing. John was in the back. But it just seems to me that it's just not exactly how things should be run if the employees are almost into a policymaking mindset. And I'm just wondering, you know, is that kind of how things are going? I mean, you guys are charged with running the department and doing policy. Are the rank and file people kind of dragging their feet and getting in the middle of that stuff?
No, sir. It's not my belief that they are. It's my belief that morale is pretty good. As with any large organization, there could be a few people in that. That morale question first came up with the transition team chair when she interviewed the management team of Southeast Region. She opened her interview by saying department overall, the morale was relatively low, and then addressed Southeast Region. We weren't allowed to give a presentation to her. It was more a question and answer, and that simple statement was there. She addressed all of our people at once, and then she interviewed individuals for over 2 days. I had the opportunity to sit next to her at Southeast Conference the second afternoon on a totally unrelated meeting, and I told her at the time that I was surprised by her comment about morale in the department overall and the and Southeast region specifically. And I asked her if she could comment on that. She said there was a couple, two individuals that were unhappy with some of the things we were doing. Some of that related to the rapid bidding that we did on the Pioneer Road, that we did on Grabena Access Road towards the end of the Governor Mikulski's administration. All of that work was in order. Part of that work was not done by the Southeast region. Part of it was done by the headquarters. Part of it was done by us, of course. I've only been with the department this time 2 years. In the 60s, I worked 6 years for the department. When we saw the draft transition report, many of the individuals responded to that, and they responded to that question of morale, and they said, no, the morale was not an issue. If you wanted to see an issue, you should have seen morale back under other administrations when all we could work on was trails. We didn't work on roads, we didn't work on highways, we didn't work on bridges and that type of thing.
Good. Thank you. And I don't mean it to be a reflection on you. I think you do a good job, and you and John, especially John, got beat up pretty good the last few months. I'm sure it's difficult, but thank you. Woody.
Yes. The question I have is for the airports and the interior airports. Seem like people are having a problem with the tanks on the well, DOT seems like it's having a problem. If people don't have a problem with the tanks, I mean, the DOT is having a problem with the tanks not being certified and stuff like that. And, you know, they're asking certain people to remove their tanks from the airport because it's not certified, but yet if you look in the neighboring villages, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's okay to put, you know, a few tanks, you know, on their airport, on the, you know, state, you know, operated airport. I mean, why they play favoritism from one village to the other? I mean, that's seems to me, you know, I mean, you know, with the high price of fuel in the state, you know, and the Denali Commission not, you know, favoring our area up in the Yukon Flats, you know, not providing us with tanks and stuff like that, you know, I mean, you know, I think we need to relook at that policy or whatever policy that you guys have in the airports.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salmon, I know we're going through an extensive effort right now to take all of our fuel tanks, the department has fuel tanks at every airport where we have equipment, and making sure that those are double-walled tanks and meet the standards, because, you know, a tank costs a few thousand dollars, but a cleanup of a spill of even a few tens of gallons costs a lot more than that, and we want to try and avoid that kind of liability. Those are our airports and our land, and when you've got a private operator on there with a tank, they could spill quite often. If there is some contamination, the responsibility for that could ultimately fall on the department, so we want to try and avoid those. Now, Your comment, if we're treating some airports differently than others, then I need to know about that, because that's not right.
Well, I think you need to look into that situation, because it's, you know, you don't say nothing to the neighboring the villages, you know, and, you know, there's several in, you know, in my district, you know. I have 94 villages in my district, and I know most of the airports, you know, pretty well. I've been to almost every one of them, and it's you know, it's kind of, to me, it's embarrassing, you know. I mean, you know, some people say, well, it's okay for my tank to be there, but, you know, then the neighboring village, they're asking them to, you know, take their tanks off, you know, and, they, you know, if you want to be fair, you got to be fair across the board. You can't just favor anybody.
Yeah. Representative Salmon, and we need to be, so I'll definitely get back in touch with you and find out which ones we are treating unfairly.
Thank you. Representative Newman?
Thank you, Chair. John, what is SHACRAT? You know, I've heard that. Is that an acronym for something? How is it funded? I'd like to know more about it. What is it?
SHACWAC is a fault. It's a geological fault in Canada, and it's along the route of the Alaska Highway through Canada. And I probably ought to let Jeff Otteson answer this one, because I might make a mistake and do something incorrectly. He knows the details on this.
I'll give you the whole story. Several years ago, about 1970, the Title 23, which funds the surface highway program, was modified to allow funding to flow to the Canadian portion of the Alaska Highway north of Haines Junction, and also the Haines Highway, the portion that lies in Canada. So it's really Section 218 of Title 23. But as the Canadians started using that money and working on that project, they called their program of projects the Shacwac program, named for the geological fault or valley that the road lies in. Many years later, that same section of law was modified to allow a different kind of money to come to Alaska, but it's all found in the same section of law, so the name Shacwac has stuck to both programs. We internally call it Canadian Shacwac and Alaskan Shacwac. It's not an acronym, it's actually a geological landmark.
Representative Newman?
Any of that have to do with the Marine Highway System funds or anything like that?
The Alaskan portion of Shacwac historically has been eligible for the Haines Highway in Alaska and also the terminals and ferries of the Marine Highway System. In 2005, the law was amended to also allow it to be used for roads that lead to ferry terminals. So the idea being it would be a way to implement the paradigm shift, if you would, for the Marine Highway System.
Go ahead, follow up. Yes, please.
I've talked to other legislators who have a concern about the Shacwac funds being connected or being used for the Juneau Access Highway. How do you address those? Is that true, or should there be a concern?
Well, it's true that we're proposing to use some of the Shacwac funds for marine highways and some of the funds for the Juneau Access Project. And the thinking behind that was that we are replacing essentially ferry service to that highway, so we end up with in the long term, a much less costly transportation solution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Along those same lines, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines is my understanding that first of all, going back to the presentation that was here last week or a week ago when we were getting an overview related to the Marine Highway System, it's my understanding that Shacwac funds can be used for upgrading the aging Marine Highway fleet. And it seems to be, at least the message that I came away was that a majority of the ferries were built back in the early 60s, and that if you were to go ahead and use these Shacwac monies to build a Juneau Access Road, then you're taking away from the maintenance of and potentially the safety of some of these ferries that are showing signs of aging and need to go ahead and have upgrades and remodels and refurbishment that's there. And so I don't understand why you're trying to balance that out, besides what your just comment was, you're trying to replace something, and right now the Juneau Access Road is not going to be in place for probably another a number of years, if not decades, and while the ferries that are down there are deteriorating at the dock.
Through the chair, there's no simple answer to this. There's clearly a very expensive system, and it was talked about at the last meeting. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do something different, we'll continue to pay those high costs for perpetuity. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the one choice that we all face. The other choice is, there were three transportation plans prepared for Southeast, going starting in 99 and two supplements to it since then. They all three are remarkably consistent. They all came to the same exact conclusion. They were prepared by different firms. They basically said, shorten your ferry links wherever possible with road links, and then try to get the boats down to day boats operating with fewer crew and a more efficient system. And what you end up with is a system that is more attractive to people, the customers, because it's less expensive to use, it's more convenient to use, it actually delivers more traffic, and at the same time, it would cost a lot less for both users and the state. That's the paradigm we're trying to get to. And at some point, you have to either continue what you're doing forevermore, or you have to start to step into this new system.
Representative Dugan?
I think I heard you say that Shacwac funds, I love that word, by the way, can be used to build roads to ferry terminals. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, that is correct.
Does that mean that there already has to be a ferry terminal for you to build the road to, or can you build the road and then build the ferry terminal?
Well, I think in this case, it could be either a ferry terminal that exists, but that would, in most cases, probably not be logical. We typically have one road that leads to a ferry terminal. But in the case of the Juneau Access Project, the project that is underneath the EIS and the approved record of decision includes a road, a ferry terminal, and ferries that run from that terminal. So it's a combination. It's like, you know, it's like the combo plate.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Johansson?
How long have we been receiving SHAQWAC money?
Mr. Chairman, exact date I'd have to look up, but it was early 90s, sometime after 91.
Has it been a pretty constant revenue stream? Probably comes, I assume, through the fiscal year, federal fiscal year. Is it pretty much the same every year? Has it changed? Is it related to some formula?
It has been erratic. It's kind of complicated to explain where SHAQWAC comes from. It is not your standard source of funding that we normally see. It is truly a very unusual and very different source of funding, and I would probably need a whiteboard to explain it. And I don't mean to be vague, but our own staff have a hard time understanding SHAQWAC, people who worked in the business.
And is this the first time, Juneau Access, that you've used it on a road project?
Through the chair, no. It was used on the Haines Highway in the past. Not a great deal, but it has been used. And that highway was always eligible, even going back to the first instance the law was passed that allowed SHAQWAC funds to come to Alaska. But it's only now since late 95, August of 05, that it has been eligible for other roads that lead to ferry terminals.
Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Do you have any more, Mr. McKinnon? Do you have any more?
Okay.
If not, well, I want to thank the presenters today, and I appreciate the committee members who are here. And with that, we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much.